Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, my little Trishy, I'm just going to say, cast your mind back to when we took our little train journey from Gatwick into town last week, and we were sat opposite two mums and two teenage daughters. Obviously, both had known each other a long time. And one of the teenage daughters, she took our breath away, didn't she, with her rudeness to her mum. I mean,
oh,
it was
my God.
The definition yes. of meanager. She started saying something about you need to have more Botox. And then she told her she'd never cooked a nice meal ever throughout the whole of her childhood. And what was her mum talking about? She enjoyed cooking. She couldn't enjoy cooking because she'd never cooked a nice meal. We wanted to grab the lady, didn't
yes.
we, the mum, and just say, oh, my goodness, I can feel your pain. But it was a level. It was like turned up to 11 in teenage rudeness.
Shouting at her to shut up as well every time the mum was speaking. Shut up, shut up. Do you know, it triggered me, didn't it? I had to put my headphones in and put my audiobook on because I found it so traumatising.
You did have to put your audiobook on. And I did want to step in as a parenting expert,
yes.
having written a book and spoken to people saying, it's okay.
Well, you were wedged in by the window.
Well, I was. But I wanted to say, it's okay to set boundaries. You can say, don't speak to me like that. And you can tell them off
yes.
In the same way that you tell children off, because you should be showing them that they can't be rude. But it was quite amusing to watch, and it did make us feel a little bit better about some of the things we all put up with as mums.
Welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Lorraine Candy.
And I'm Trish Halpin.
If you're living in a hormonal hot house, feeling a bit overwhelmed and in need of some positive, uplifting and comforting guidance on how to lead a more magnificent midlife, then this is the show for you.
We chat to celebrities and experts on all things midlife, from menopause and perimenopause to parenting teens, via fashion, beauty, wellness, nutrition, fitness, careers, relationships, caring for elderly relatives and your finances.
Yes, we ask experts and famous guests all the questions you need answered to have a happier, healthier and more harmonious second act.
So we're still on a bit of a high from our weekend together in Cornwall, and something strange happened to me, Lorraine, this week. So I've been thinking about your lovely home county a lot. You know, when something kind of stays with you and you're just sort of feeling it and thinking about it, so to speak. I had an unexpected flashback.
Was it to when you won your shot put medal? One of those flashbacks? Another sporting sock in the swimming
no.
costume gussock flashback? No?
No, it was Cornwall related.
Cornwall related flashback. You're not going to tell me that you were thinking about Guinevere or becoming a Knight of the Round Table or King Arthur, none of which is true, but it's quite a nice Cornish fantasy.
It is. No, I wasn't any of those things in my past life, if that's what you're thinking. But I have to say, I wouldn't have mind being Poll Dark's Demelza in a past life. But that's another story. What it was I had completely forgotten that I went on holiday to Cornwall when I was about 10 with my friend Sam and her parents. We stayed in a mobile home on a little sort of farm in Boscastle. And I just looked it up on the old Google Maps. And it's just up the road from you in Polzeath. And I don't think you've mentioned Boscastle to me before in your many, many chats about Cornwall.
Well, it's quite famous, Boscastle, because it had the terrible flood which swept most of the village away. It's right in the valley and it's a harbour, and the flood, it was just a mud flood basically, which took houses, cars, everything out. And I know a bit more about this because old Michael Portillo was walking in Boscastle for one of the many shows he inexplicably gets given on the telly.
Yes.
It's got a really famous little restaurant called the Rocket Store, Boscastle. You would like it, Trish. I can't go there, serves lobster. And in our family, it's famous because the dog nearly fell into the harbour when the tide was in. Obviously, she's quite tiny. Whenever anything happens near water, everyone just looks at me as if to say, you're the one to jump in fully clothed and rescue that dog.
You're the swimmer. Yes, exactly. Oh my goodness, bit of a place of drama for you then. Well, it was the first place I ever went rock pooling. It was the first time I just saw these memories coming back. I wrote a postcard to my grandparents in Ireland. I remember my friend's dad telling me how to write a postcard and get all the information into that tiny little space. And I remember buying this strange wooden spoon, which had this little painted face and a ribbon tied round its neck as a souvenir for my mum. And the other thing I remember was I had a lovely pair of brown corduroy flares that I wore during that holiday. Isn't that amazing? All of those memories flooding back.
It's funny, isn't it? Little jogged your little memory that weekend away with me, didn't it? I bet your mum loved that wooden spoon. We do love all those things they bring back, don't we, Trish, that we have to keep. Funny old gathering of misshapen stuff in the back of a cupboard. And you've been a style icon, obviously, Trish, from an early age, because actually brown corduroy is in at the moment. I'm glad we sparked some vivid and lovely memories for you. We're going to be continuing with some other good news stories this week, because there really is so much to love about being a woman in midlife, especially all these memories flooding back. I had a nice little memory this week because I met the lovely Nell, who runs Daunt's Bookshop in Hampstead. I was doing a book talk with Julia Samuel, talking about both our books. And she'd brought her lovely mum, who was in her 60s, and her dad, who was a little bit older. He was the only man in the room. And in preparation, Trish, he'd listened to my book on Audible on the train on the way up. Can you imagine?
That's good. Yes.
It was really lovely. I mean, my dad hasn't even read my book, so I was very pleased. But afterwards, Nell wrote me a little card and she said it was so important. So she's in her mid-20s. She wanted to thank me on behalf of all the midlife women that go into a bookshop, because obviously most bookshops have a community of midlife women around them. She wrote that it was so important that we were spreading such an important message about midlife to the women of the bookshop, which I thought was a really lovely thing.
Oh, that is a really nice bit of good news this week. And we've had some other lovely feel-good stories on the Facebook group too. Some are just small things, no biggie, as the teens might say. A little boost of confidence, a little boost of happiness. So we thought we'd just share some of these with you, lovely listeners. So Lisa posted a whole lot of lovely pictures of her looking very serene and calm and beautiful on holiday somewhere lovely. And she said, hello, everyone. Just wanted to say a big thank you for all your wonderful travel suggestions for my first time solo traveling. I went to Antibes in the south of France and had a wonderful time. She certainly did, by the looks of things. Solo travelling, very, very good. Important theme for all of us midlifers. And Orla had a very different type of feel-good experience, but no less empowering. She says, just tackled a man who breezed past the obvious queue in the ski place. Enraged. So while he was being served, I tapped him on the shoulder and said, there is a queue. Lots of surprised stares all around me, but he apologised. It seems small, but a lifetime of men pushing past me flashed before me, and that was it. Love the menopause.
Yes, you do enter that kind of say what you think era, just not going to put up with it, not going to mould and work around these men, don't you? Go all or I say. Now, this is a good one that was on the Facebook. It was posted anonymously, and you can understand why when I read it. This is a positive post about sex. My husband and I had not been intimate for 3 years until a couple of weeks ago. This was due to it hurting when we were intimate and then just losing interest in sex. Now, since we have started to be intimate, I can't stop thinking about him and the sex, even asking him if he wanted to go to bed this afternoon, brackets Sunday. I think he thinks all his Christmases have come at once. Thanks to HRT, I think I'm starting to feel like me again. And believe my hubby is loving it. Hang in there, ladies. It does get better. Well, I like that.
Yes.
I like that one, Trish. Yes. Even on a Sunday. It's all great news. Now, as we often do on the show, we're going to take things in a totally different direction, although we're going to go from sex to Shakespeare, no less. It's actually quite a lot of sex in Shakespeare, Trish. I did a bit of Googling.
There is.
That'll come up on my computer history, sex in Shakespeare. And it says on Google that over half the plays have some mention of sex. I'm going to be testing you on sex in Shakespeare later on, Trish. That'll be the next quiz.
Yes, like that one.
Our special guest today is Tamara Harvey, the first female co-artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. This is uncharted territories for us, Trish, because I know you like a bit of Shakespeare and always hoofing yourself off to the theatre. but we've never really had a co-artistic director or an artistic director from these. We haven't had any theatre people on, have we, for a long time?
Yes, that is a special treat. And we have more treats lined up, because after we chat tomorrow, we're going to be sharing our live interview from Cornwall, the retreat, with the wonderful somatic movement coach, Naheed de Beljon. Do you want to give listeners a wee hint as to what that's all about?
Naheed is going to explain how very tiny repetitive movements, with little breaks in between them, release bits of your nervous system and encourage the body to soothe itself. She's written a book about this, and it's a method she's created called the Human Method, which we, well, it was really powerful. We both had a little go, didn't we, Trish, lying on the floor?
Yes.
A little bit of shaking and rocking. And I've done it twice, and both times I've had the most fantastic night's sleep.
Amazing. I slept like a log. It was really quite powerful, quite a special and unusual thing to do. I loved it. But talking of sleep, one more good news story to share. This is from Ruth, who says, I just want to share a win thanks to the podcast. My husband has had raging sleep maintenance insomnia, which means he falls asleep easily but then wakes several times or more a night. 5 years, he's been constantly exhausted. We've tried pretty much everything to improve it, plus years on NHS waiting lists for blood tests, etc., etc. We had heard but resisted sleep restriction therapies. It sounds so brutal. You spend so little time in bed that you end up exhausted, but you train your mind that your bed is where you sleep solidly. So it's a sort of, it certainly is an investment process. But after hearing Dr. Michael Mosley talking about it on the podcast and reading the page on his website, we've given it a try. It has indeed been a brutal 3.5 weeks of husband not coming to bed till 1:30 a.m. However, exhausted he felt and always getting up when the alarm goes off at 6:50 a.m. But last night he slept solidly for just over 5 hours. This hasn't happened since his insomnia started. We're tracking his sleep with a Withings under mattress sleep tracker, which was well worth every penny. All fingers crossed it continues. He's feeling positive and empowered. God, sorting your sleep out.
Good news, isn't it? Dr. Michael Mosley's sleep thing, I recommended it last night at the book talk, actually, to two women who were saying, I've hit midlife and I can't sleep anymore. I'm on HRT. You know, once you get out of it, it's really hard to get into it, because the brain takes a long time to change something, a pattern that it's in. So you really do have to try. So really pleased to hear that, Ruth.
Yes, right. Well, I think we need to link it back up with Shakespeare, because I like to tie up loose ends, as you know. So
I
thought
I'd do
a little Shakespeare sleep quote. He wrote, "To die to sleep perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in this sleep of death, what dreams may come." What about that?
It's like your French, isn't it? Practicing out all this stuff. I know what you're going to ask me what play it's from. I think I'm going to say, gosh, is it Hamlet or Othello? Something like, sounds like one of the Menzies plays.
Yes, bang on, Hamlet. It's a Hamlet one, isn't it? The famous Hamlet one.
All right then, Lady Macbeth, I think it's time to meet Tamara. For today's show, we're about to step into a world we haven't really visited on Postcards from Midlife before, the world of theatre. And taking us there is Tamara Harvey, 46, the first woman in the hot seat permanently as the boss of the Royal Shakespeare Company. Tamara became co-artistic director of the RSC alongside Daniel Evans in June 2023, and is charged with steering this very British institution forward as a more diverse, modern and inclusive creative space. Award-winning director Tamara, who is married with two children, aged 6 and 8, uprooted the family's life from a small Welsh village where she was artistic director of Theatre Clwyd to busy Stratford-upon-Avon, and she'll be talking about how she made that choice with us today. Tamara was born in Botswana but grew up in Massachusetts and Brighton before going to uni in Bristol and training at the Shakespeare Theatre of New Jersey. Her theatre career began under the legendary Mark Rylance, and she's worked in the West End as well as the USA. Tamara will be telling us how her plans to shake up Shakespeare are going and how she balances her personal life with the demanding theatre life, definitely not a 9-to-5 role, and will be asking how exactly you co-manage one of the country's most beloved arts institutions during a cost-of-living crisis following a pandemic. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Tamara.
Hello.
Lovely to have you here. It's very exciting. Because we've had theatre actors on the show before. We had Juliet Stevenson, But we've never had an artistic director whose background is directing. So I think for our listeners, tell us a little bit about why you wanted to work in theatre and how you got where you are today.
Well, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a ballet dancer. In fact, when I was a little kid, I wanted to be a postman in the mornings and a ballet dancer at night. And I did loads and loads of ballet. And at the age of 16, I realised, well, the catalyst was I got cast as Kate in the school production of Kiss Me, Kate. And I realised that I couldn't do ballet training and rehearsals because I was doing the ballet about kind of 6 days a week. And so I had to make a choice. And I think I realised at that point I was only ever going to be a mediocre ballet dancer. So I decided to do Kate. And then the school shows, so I was at a state comp in Brighton and I didn't have a brilliant time at school, but the school shows were the place where I always felt at home. And I think that was the moment where I thought, oh, I'd quite like to spend my life in theatre, but I don't want to be an actor, because I always had a kind of little voice on my shoulder going, oh, why are you standing over there? And I could never lose myself in it. And I was very fortunate in that when I was 17, an opera company at the Brighton Arts Festival, where I was living, where I was growing up, had an education scheme where each member of their team was shadowed by a student. And I got on shadowing, interestingly, given what I'm doing now, the co-directors. And after about 10 minutes in the rehearsal room, it was love at first sight. I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be a director. Without, at that point, any real clue as to what it meant or what it would involve.
And what kind of life is the theatre life? Just because most of us end up in these, you know, 9-to-5 jobs, and that's great. But we just imagine you flitting all over the country and here, there and everywhere. And then when it comes to that point in life, maybe when you have a family, how does that all work?
I think the quickest answer to that would be that it doesn't really. But the thing about being an artistic director that is slightly different from being a freelance director, which I was before, is that your day does start at 9, because you kind of have the normal working day, 9-to-5 of meetings, and then it carries on into the evening with theatre shows. So you just have to find a way to start being strict. And I think the thing that's been interesting, that's been a real learning curve for me, is that I have had to figure out how to be an artistic director and a mum in a way that a lot of the artistic directors that I encountered when I was a freelance director weren't. And so I didn't really have kind of models, people to model it on. And the artistic directors I had worked for, who were the kind of artistic director that I wanted to be because I thought they were brilliant, were in the building from, you know, 9 in the morning until midnight, and absolutely kind of the first to arrive, the last to leave. So figuring out how to be an artistic director without being that artistic director has been quite tricky.
Well, what advice have you got for women?
Give yourself a break. There are practical things that I do where I block out time in the diary and am now quite bold about going keep clear bedtime so that I can do bedtime with the kids, or trying to set quite strict rules for myself about how many evenings a week I'm out of the house. But I think the most difficult thing is giving myself permission and then trying to silence the voice of guilt in my head.
I guess it's been a bit of a learning curve though, hasn't it? So when the kids were small, I just can't imagine having a newborn or a one-year-old and being able to do a job that took me away in the evenings. I mean, Trish and I had to go away a bit for jobs, and you were always in that place. What sort of situations did you encounter perhaps that might be helpful for women to hear about, and what did you learn from it?
It was almost easier when they were little, I think, for two reasons. One, they're more portable, and two, they are less good at articulating quite how cross they are with you for being out. So when my son, who's now 6, was 3 months old, I started rehearsals for a co-production that Theatre Clwyd, where I was artistic director previously, was doing with the National Theatre. And the National, because we were rehearsing there, kind of Clwyd was already brilliant about it because they'd had to work with me to figure out all sorts of things when my daughter was little. But the National was equally great. So they gave him his own dressing room between two actors that I love, Lloyd Hutchinson and Charlie Edwards, opposite Rory Kinnear and Anne-Marie Duff. So he had his own dressing room. I was able to bring him into the theatre. It meant I was able to pop and breastfeed or just spend some time with him on tea breaks. And then when we went to Clwyd to tech and open the show, the team there had created a little room for him with a sign on the door saying trainee theatre maker. And actually, in some ways, that sign and the sign they put on the dressing room door in at the National were the biggest things, because they said they were a signal from my colleagues that it was okay, that it was okay that I was doing that. The other thing I started doing when I was that same period when I was rehearsing at the National and he was tiny, having never been particularly engaged with social media, I started tweeting about the difficulties of it. And it arose actually just from a moment of frustration. I was at a bus stop and I was really proud of myself because I'd managed to get him and my daughter out of the house. I'd got her to nursery. I'd got him in a sling. We were at the bus stop and I was going to make it to rehearsals in time. And an older gentleman at the bus stop looked at him and the fact that he didn't have any socks on and said, "Cold feet, poor boy." And I was so furious. And I didn't have anywhere to put the fury. So, of course, being, you know, terribly polite, I went, and smiled. And then I was just sat on the bus thinking, how dare you? How dare you criticize the lack of socks? And so I tweeted about it. And the volume of response that I got from other working mums, working parents, sympathizing, expressing, you know, telling similar stories was so overwhelming that it made me think, oh, I think there is a need, particularly in the theatre industry, for us to speak out about the challenges. And that old adage about a problem shared is a problem halved. And I am in a privileged position in that I am employed. I think if I was a freelancer at that point, I'd have felt more nervous about doing it because I'd have thought, oh God, if people know that I'm a mum, they might not give me the job. And so I started kind of telling the narrative of what it was like being a working mum on Twitter. And that made a huge difference to me because of all the replies that I got and that sense of being part of a wider community of people trying to figure it out.
Just one more family question before we move on to the work, which we're very excited to talk about. Because you moved from Clwyd to the RSC in Stratford, uprooting your whole family, moving, that's quite a big thing, isn't it, to do and for your career. How was that and what did you get right and what might you do differently if you had to do it again?
First off, I was really lucky that we moved around a lot when I was a kid. So we lived on three different continents by the time I was four. And so it didn't feel that massive. Of course, how it felt to me is totally different from how it felt to my kids. And it did feel massive to them. My husband was brilliant about it. And I think also excited to be a bit closer to London because of a lot of his work is there. My executive director, joint chief exec at Theatre Clwyd, had moved his kids to Clwyd when they were about the same age. And his advice was, when you tell them about the job and that it's going to involve moving, do this. And I followed it to the letter. So I said, kids, I've got a new job. It's really exciting. And it means we're going to move to a different house and a different town and a different country. And they, you know, got upset and my daughter started crying and saying, but I want you to be the artistic director of Theatre Clwyd. Theatre Clwyd's our home, because she kind of grown up running around the corridors there. And then I said, and because I've got this new job, it means we can go to Disneyland.
Oh. Yeah, brilliant. That so, did it.
Bribery, yeah. Basically bribery. I think the other thing was we tried really hard to bed in as quickly as possible. I mean, we were the most aggressively friendly parents in the playground. We were the most aggressively kind of social team for a while. I became completely shameless about messaging other parents and saying, can we have a play date? Can we have a play date again? So we did all of that. I think what I would do differently, I would have made more space for the kids to also talk about how hard it was. I think anytime they expressed their unhappiness or how difficult it was, my default position was to try and kind of cheerlead and talk about how amazing it was as well. And I think the shift came when I kind of recognized that I wasn't allowing space for their emotions about it, their negative emotions about it. And so it really shifted when I started creating space for them to be able to talk about how hard it was.
That's all good advice. So you as a director have been a bit of a kind of feminist, championing feminist plays. And we were looking at reading your CV, which is so impressive. And you directed Home, I'm Darling by Laura Wade, which starred Catherine Parkinson, whom Trish and I just hero worship. We absolutely love her. That was nominated for 5 Olivier Awards and it won Best New Comedy. But how is the world of theatre in terms of women now and kind of the work of women and the starring of women? I mean, we don't know much about that world. Is it that I'm guessing there's been a Me Too moment, like, you know, we work in media. That moment hasn't quite come for media. It will do soon, I feel. What's that world like in terms of women? And is it changing at all for the better, particularly around pay, perhaps?
I think it is changing. The interesting thing is I think it is changing and getting better at the same time as I get older, I find I'm getting more and more cross. So I have to kind of take a step back in order to acknowledge that it's changing. I think the roles on stage and the roles in front of the camera are becoming a little bit more balanced. In theatre, I think we have tended to be better around the pay gap question, because often a company of actors are paid the same, or we've been quite front-footed, certainly in the places I've worked, about making sure that there is equality in pay. The inequality, and this is something that my co-artistic director, Daniel Evans, and I are really kind of facing into at the RSC. The inequality, of course, arrives from the roles available, and that's more noticeable in Shakespeare. So you might be committed to paying men and women the same, but if there are fewer female roles, then there is an inequality in that. So trying to find ways that either we are gender flipping within Shakespeare, or that we're ensuring that the rest of our program, and Shakespeare is only about 40% of what we do at the RSC, the rest of our program is really giving opportunities for women to play leading roles. I think in terms of the rest of the theatre world, sorry, the rest of the jobs that happen in any given theatre, there is still a divide, but it varies across different departments. So, you know, for example, wardrobe teams, costume making still tends to be very female. The technical teams in theatre, lighting, sound, still tends to be very male. So quite a lot of the work we're doing as well is around opening up access and opportunities to those through apprenticeships, through pathways from our amazing creative learning and engagement team and all of the work they do in schools, so that young people become aware of the other jobs that you can do in theatre, and we make sure that when we leave the place, we leave it in a better state than when we found it.
Now, we love going to the theatre, but quite novice at what goes on behind the scenes. We'd love to know, what does a co-artistic director do? What's a typical day for you, Tamara?
There isn't really a typical day.
Of course not.
Daniel and I are responsible for all of the artistic programme. We are also joint chief executives with our executive director. So whilst our executive director is kind of more concerned with, as it were, the business side of things, we're very fortunate in that our executive director that we've just appointed, Andrew Leveson, is also really interested in the creative and the artistic. And Daniel and I are both also really interested in the business side of things. So ideally, you have a kind of a brilliant interweaving of those things, I think, in your leadership team. But we are specifically responsible for everything that goes on our stages and the wider artistic program, whether that's in learning or in classrooms or in the digital sphere. We've got an amazing digital development team. So working with our senior colleagues, they'll absolutely kind of lead on that. But we have, as it were, final say. And we're responsible for all of the artistic teams, whether freelance or employed, that are part of the RSC. I'll give you an untypical day. On Monday this week, we started the day with meetings with a writer. We had a meeting with a director, both talking about what the stories are that they might want to tell. Then we spent a glorious half hour in the rehearsal room for The Buddha of Suburbia, which is the show by Hanif Qureshi and co-adapted by Hanif and Emma Rice, that is the first show in the Swan Theatre in our season. And we were saying hello to the actors, talking a bit about what we want our RSC to be. And then they did a bit of a sharing of the work that they've done so far. They're only a week in, but the work they've done so far in the rehearsal room. So that's kind of part of the best bit of the job. And then we had a meeting with someone in the world of politics to talk about kind of arts policy. We had, I'm trying to think what I was running back across town for. I had a meeting with an actor, again, to talk about the stories they might be interested in telling. And then I was working on Pericles. So we're in the final design stages and in the beginning casting stages of Pericles, which is my first show that I'm directing for the RSC, which will be this summer. And then I got the train back in order to make it home for tea and bedtime stories. And then that evening, after the kids were in bed, I had another meeting about a future show that we're just in kind of casting conversations around.
Well, it's the dream. It's the dream day for Trish. Look, so
brilliant.
Trish and I started working together 4 years ago, we had both been editor-in-chiefs of, well, all the magazines between us, basically, on and off. but we had never worked together. So we set up Postcards from Midlife together, not really knowing how the other one worked. I mean, we'd known each other for 25 years, but we knew we liked each other and we knew that we were actually quite opposite personalities. You and Daniel applied for the job together. It's not a job share. So how does that work? Does it mean that you're great at conflict? I mean, you know, I can spot a fizzy Trish a mile off, so I know how to be. She can spot a kind of disorganized, slightly energetic, we have to do all these amazing things me a mile off to calm that down. How does it work between you and Daniel? And what qualities do you think people need to work in a partnership like this?
I mean, first of all, I would say we're still figuring it out. And I kind of hope we will continue to be figuring it out all the way through the partnership, because I think continually just checking in and making sure that we're bringing out the absolute best in each other is part of it. We had both worked together before in different ways. So I had directed for him when he was at the artistic director at Sheffield and I was a freelance director. So we'd kind of got a bit of a sense of how the other works in a room and how we engage with teams and staff and kind of where our artistic taste lies. And then we'd co-commissioned together when we were both artistic directors, we'd co-produced. So we had a bit of a working relationship already. I think the key thing for me was that I felt like we really shared the same values, believed in the same things, believed in the same goals in terms of what art, what theatre is and can be, and putting audiences and artists first and making sure that the work is really speaking to the world now. So all of those kind of key fundamentals were there. We've learned quite a lot through the process of applying. You know, the speed at which we both work, we're both pretty quick. We can both be impatient, so we have to really catch each other on that. The kind of brilliant stuff that happens when we don't agree about a particular project and how that can really put the other person in the position of needing to properly clarify thinking or kind of open themselves up to different possibilities. I think the most useful, tangible thing we've done is we have worked with a company called Red Tulip, who look at your decision-making pattern. So it's a very practical approach. They film you for an hour and a half in conversation, and then they turn the sound off and watch the film and study your movement using Laban, which is a kind of movement theory. And they use that to draw up what they consider to be your decision-making profile and divide decisions into three parts. So there's attention, intention, and commitment. And that's helped in a couple of ways. First of all, it's just really interesting to have someone else reflect back at you how you come to decisions and what process you go through. So for example, I am a prober. So I like to ask a load of questions and get a huge amount of information. And then I don't spend very much time in the middle of it. I spend a little bit of time kind of prioritizing. And then I leap fairly quickly to commitment. So now that I know myself, know that about myself, and I know Daniel's profile and where it chimes and where it's different, that's really helpful. But also it's just given us a vocabulary to talk about what the other person needs and where they might need more time to think about a certain thing, or where they might need to go away and consider, or where we might both be able to just leap to a decision.
Now, we should talk about Shakespeare, the Royal Shakespeare Company. A little bit of a two-pronged one here. First of all, we've got a lot of mums listening who will have teenagers about to do their GCSEs, and they'll be pulling their hair out, having to do Macbeth or Romeo and Juliet. So I suppose the first question, why is Shakespeare still so important for kids to study and to be such a strong part of our, you know, British English culture? And tell us what you're doing at the RSC with Shakespeare, because I believe you've done an 80-minute version of As You Like It. Tell us what else it is that you're doing. So two questions in one there.
I'm going to answer the first with a bit of an example. As I said, we've got this creative learning and engagement team led by the brilliant Jackie O'Hanlon. And we work with 280 schools across the country, bringing rehearsal techniques. So rather than using kind of book-based techniques, we use rehearsal techniques to explore the works of Shakespeare. And there is a cluster of five schools in Middlesbrough that we've been working with for 10 years. And across those 10 years, we can now categorically say that literacy rates in those five schools have gone from 68% to 93%. And that's in primary school children. So that for me is really useful, because I could sit here and talk about how Shakespeare's themes are universal and how he explores the complexity of human nature and how the spaces he leaves in between the words are where our imagination can pour in and part of the reason that we find his work so glorious. But actually, there's a much more tangible thing, which is that when young people are exposed to Shakespeare in a way that is active, up on their feet and fun, their literacy rates improve, their confidence in public speaking improves. Daniel and I spent a day at an amazing school in Stoke, and they've been working with the RSC again for 10 years, and they now use rehearsal techniques in other subjects, in all the subjects across the curriculum, from the nursery kids, so the three-year-olds who also learn the stories of Shakespeare, right through to 11-year-olds. And they all stood up and did scenes from Macbeth. And the confidence of these kids was intimidating and brilliant. One of the teachers told us a story of one of the girls in the playground who'd come up to her the day before, age 9, and said, "Oh, miss, I'm so sluggardized." So I think the reason Shakespeare is important, quite aside from, as I said, all the things that we know, is that he fires our imagination. The works have such an incredibly rich vocabulary that it opens us up to the possibilities of language. And one of the things that I really respond to, that I think young people do too, young and old, is that his characters are not linear. They're messy and complex and human in a way that I think is really important in a world where we're losing nuance and we're losing empathy. And so we watch Macbeth, and both Macbeth and Lady Macbeth aren't just villains. He refuses to allow us to dismiss them as just bad people, because they keep talking to us and they keep telling us how hard things are and asking us to understand. That's why he's even more important today than he has been at any other time, really.
And you are a woman in midlife. You're in your mid-40s now, you're 46. And we talked to all our guests about this because, frankly, no one had talked to any women about this before we started asking them questions. So you're 10 years younger than Trish and I, so I'm assuming you've got a bit more knowledge about menopause, perimenopause. You're listening to the conversation. You're seeing these big celebrities talking about it. What do you know and what do you want to know, and how do you feel about getting older and aging?
Oh, I feel really conflicted on this, and I talked to my mum about it. I feel really torn between wanting to know all of it so that I understand what's coming and wanting to bury my head in the sand and pretend none of it's going to happen. I had a colleague at Theatre Clwyd, Hannah, who was amazing in starting to bring the conversation out into the open around menopause. So I learned a lot from her. I think we are still in a moment in society where we're having to constantly challenge the use of that word as a kind of catch-all for any kind of difficulties that women are facing at work. I find that bit difficult, and difficult for myself, thinking about how I might articulate difficulties or needs at the point at which I start going through it. Because I think I'm really aware of those negative connotations and the way that men, not all men, but some men still raise their eyebrows or, you know, roll their eyes. I don't know. As you can tell, I have really complicated feelings about all of it.
We can tell by the expression on your face how you're expressing your conflict and conviction. Anyway, you might not have to worry about that for a while yet. But I think we should just end on some of the highlights that you've got coming up. Which actors are we going to be seeing? What's going to tempt us to the RSC?
I find this question so difficult because, of course, Daniel and I have poured our heart and soul into the programme, and we've announced a year. So we've announced 17 shows. And the reason they're in there amongst the hundreds of shows that we could have programmed is because we passionately believe in every single one of them. So it's really difficult to pull things out. I'm going to go for the first ones because those are the ones most present in my mind. Love's Labour's Lost is our opening show in the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, which is the big theatre. And Emily Burns, the director, who's an associate director at the National Theatre and at the Bridge, is one of the most brilliantly articulate and thoughtful and inspirational people, directors I've met. The world of it that she's chosen. So in Love's Labour's Lost, you have a group of young men who have decided to live life by these very strict rules. They're not going to speak to women, then they're going to fast, they're going to, you know, all these things that are going to make them better humans. So she kind of asked the question, how could those conditions exist in the world now? And so in her version, a tech bro has bought an island and has dictated the rules on that island. So it's going to be a really fun, really glamorous, really funny world. And it's one of the cast is Luke Thompson, who's just been nominated for an Olivier Award for his performance in A Little Life, and is one of the brothers on Bridgerton. So I think that will be a glorious one to start with. The other one I should talk about, because I mentioned it earlier, and I always feel a bit embarrassed talking about my own work, but I'm doing Pericles in The Swan, and I'm really lucky that my Pericles is Alfie Enoch, who's an actor that I worked with a couple of times during the pandemic. We did online versions of What a Carve Up, the Jonathan Coe novel, and Dorian Gray. And Alfie's a wonderful actor who I think is just going to be dazzling in that role if I don't get in the way.
Well, it's really lovely to hear you talk about it with such enthusiasm, and also to point out, I guess, that the RSC has also introduced 25,000 tickets for under £25 or less. So it is a much more accessible place, perhaps, than it was. Certainly, you know, when I grew up in middle of nowhere in Cornwall, there was just no hope of me ever seeing any live Shakespeare anywhere as a child. So I know now that you do a TikTok thing for tickets for 14 to 19-year-olds as well. So it is becoming more accessible.
I realised the one thing I didn't pick up on was the As You Like It. So if you can only make it to Stratford for the day, we're doing daytime performances. As You Like It's going to be 80 minutes long. All tickets are £20. Kids are £10. And I think it's going to be a really boisterous, fun show. So that's the one I'm really looking forward to taking my kids to.
That's very exciting. Thank you very much for sharing your passion and enthusiasm, Tamara.
Thank you.
So many thanks to Tamara. What a fascinating, fascinating guest. I feel a bit enthused by that. So we are moving swiftly, as we do on this podcast, Trish, from one fabulous working woman to another fabulous working woman with our How to Win at Midlife, which is all about somatic movement, with Naheed de Beljon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we have another special treat from our podcast in Cornwall, live from Cornwall in the beautiful sunshine. We've got a guest today on the show who has been part of the retreat here, and it's time to meet Naheed de Beljon, who is author of the new book, Soothe, the book your nervous system has been longing for. We've been lucky enough to have some sessions with Naheed here, who is a somatic movement educator, as well as a yoga and breathwork teacher. She's been a pivotal part of the London fitness and wellness industry for more than 20 years and has developed what she calls the human method, a unique system of restorative rocking aimed at relaxing and rejuvenating your body. We'll be asking Naheed how she devised the human method, and how it works for overwhelmed, weary, but promise-filled midlife women. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Naheed.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been such a delight spending time with you and with everyone here. It's just been delightful. What a charming retreat.
Now, I think we should start by telling listeners a bit about you, because you say a lot about where you come from and what you went through and what you've experienced and how that contributed to you developing the human method. And in the book, you write, I started running when I left home, kickboxing when I wanted to leave my first husband, yoga when I left a highly paid, highly stressed job. You say in the book that you've suffered panic attacks, neuralgia, and you almost died from a gangrenous appendix.
because you say you simply didn't pay attention to your body and you didn't know how to soothe it. So tell us a bit about your background and how it led to the human method.
I think like most people who get into this sort of work, you're always trying to resolve issues, trying to figure out how you're going to be in this world, knowing that, you know, one day we're going to die. All Eastern philosophies are based on that. The suffering that you have, you're born and you know you're going to die. So how do you make sense of your life? My background was quite dysfunctional and I had chronic anxiety attacks. I couldn't get on the tube because I was so anxious about it. All of my life, I was just looking for lots of different things that I could use, do to make sure that I didn't feel, you know, I could kind of mitigate those emotions. And so I used willpower a lot. And then I would, you know, have lots of structure and regimes that kind of worked for a bit and then they didn't. So I threw myself into excessive exercise. And I think a lot of us do that. Or I would go out and have really amazing experiences just to fill that hole and kind of to keep myself really busy, because I didn't love being still and I didn't love being quiet, because actually my thoughts were quite painful to me. So it was kind of trying to figure out how I could almost outrun them. It all worked for a bit and then it didn't. And I got into meditation and I got into yoga. And those things are really brilliant for when you have an hour here and an hour there and you can roll your mat out. But I think what I was looking for, the missing ingredient for me, was what you can do in real time as you go through a bit of anxiety, or just to, yeah, help you get over something very quickly so that you can function. And I had studios in central London and I had yoga studios, my kind of all happened quite organically, and fitness studios. And what I found were that the people that came to my studios, you'd have them about 20 minutes in every class. They'd start off really stressed. You'd sort of be able to unclench the phone from their hands and then they might relax a little bit. And then they'd really get into the yoga and then they'd start getting wound up again so that they could go back into their lives to do whatever they had to do. They weren't really functioning properly. They weren't having periods. They couldn't get pregnant. They were really stressed. And so I wanted to get under the bonnet of that. So I got into nervous system regulation, found out a lot about the nervous system, got into all the practices, understood and researched all the practices that would help you to bring that back into balance. And then worked one-to-one with lots of clients and kind of trialed and tweaked everything until the human method was born. So I'm going to very quickly explain to you what the nervous system is, because then that might be really useful. So it's your brain, your spinal cord, and all of the messages from that into your organs and your body, and from your organs and body back to your spinal cord and brain. So my work involves listening to those signals, because of course I didn't listen to them once upon a time. So listening to those signals, interpreting them, and then deciding what it is that you need at any given moment. And so the movements and the human method, actually what it does is it rewires your brain through movement for better emotional health, is how I now describe it.
So can you talk us maybe a little bit more specifically through some of parts of the human method, particularly somatic movement? I think that's a phrase we're hearing a bit more about these days. Tell us what it is. What does it mean?
So somatic movement, soma, means of the body. So you're moving from your felt sense. It feels a bit odd because you're not exercising and it's not performative. When we're met with that, we're like, oh, what is that? You know, that's what we're used to doing. We're used to doing hard and fast. We generally tend to beast our bodies and push them and control them in some way. And this is not that at all. So you'll be lying on the floor and I will guide you through very gentle movements, because the brain, your brain gets really interested in novel and new things. When you're doing novel and new things, what happens then is all your focus goes on that, and your brain then just tells your nervous system, like, send this energy, send this your effort and your focus. And it lets go of the muscle contraction that you then don't need. Because actually what stress is contraction of muscle.
So one of the reasons we wanted you to come on the retreat and we wanted to talk about your book, Soothe, is that midlife women do, I think, and I'm right in saying, because we've all been chatting, haven't we, there is a real sense of overwhelm that we sometimes get, and our window of tolerance on stress starts to close. Lots of different things happen in our life. Why would something like this be particularly good for this age group of women?
Well, I think it's particularly good for anyone, but particularly good for this age of women is that when you get to your perimenopause, when you get about mid-40s, things are on the shift and they change, but we don't know who to be. We don't know, you know, maybe it's changing now, but, you know, we didn't have a lot of role models for who to then be after being young and then old. Yeah, it was kind of like a real from there to there. And in cities, actually, you hang on to your youth a lot younger, don't you? Kind of skateboard still and dress really young and all the rest of it.
Yeah, that's what Trish does. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You really try and hold on to it.
She wears a baseball cap does backwards she? And, yeah.
What's really great, I think, about this work is it allows you to play with your self-image so that you get to expand it. Because for most of us, I mean, certainly for me, when I got to menopause, I went loopy, actually. I kind of thought I knew everything. Yeah, same. Yeah, I've read your book. You know, it's great. I didn't get it in time, though. I didn't get it before it all happened, darn it. But so I went loopy. I knew, understood the physical symptoms. And I was like, yep, I can handle that. You know, I've been in this world for a really long time. It really floored me. I went to the doctors in the end, and the thing that really floored me was I didn't sleep for 3 months, and sleep has always been the thing that I can just go to, revives me, I can sleep easily, I can sleep for, you know, ideally, if I could live the life I really wanted to, I'm getting there, but you know, 8 hours, 9 hours a night, I'm good, you know, that really
Olympic
suits me.
Olympic sleeping. Yeah,
it really suits me. But my sleep went out the window, so I just went really loopy. And then with that, got a bit paranoid, felt really vulnerable, and just thought, who the hell am I? I'd sold my business. Oh, yeah, in the whole throes of that, I did everything. I sold my business that I'd had for 13 years. So it was doing really well, but I just thought, no, I don't want this. I don't want the responsibility. And I literally took loads of people on a retreat, came back and closed the door that Friday. I was like, I'm not doing it. And I also moved to the sea after living, you know, I'm a Londoner. I'd lived in London all my life. And I was just saying to you, wasn't I? My husband years ago had said, one day, we could leave London. And I thought, it's time for husband number three, because I ain't going anywhere. And so I did everything, sold my business, moved to the seaside, and, you know, just shook everything up. I think I quite like chaos. And reinvented myself and then found the things that I think are really important for women our age, which is purpose and peace. I think it's actually a really exciting time. I've had quite a few conversations with people over the years, but lots of people here, about not being who you were. That's the thing, you really need to let go of that, because of course you're not going to be who you were, because you are aging. And actually, aging is a privilege. I mean, look at what's going on around the world. It's a real privilege. So I think it's a real shame to not embrace that unknown. My kind of favorite place to be is that liminal space, because as women, you don't get a chance to be in that liminal space. So it's actually a really powerful time, and I just wish we could enjoy it more. But the reason the work is so important is that you get to play with who you are, and you get to kind of figure it out.
And how do we bring this into our daily life if we're not all going to be able to do sessions all the time? Obviously, there's the book. I'm assuming there's some practical elements of what we can do from the book. Yeah. What little things could we be doing?
So the very first thing that you can do is a breathing practice that we all did, which was 6 seconds in, 6 seconds out. But the 6x6 is dead easy. You know, 6 seconds in, 6 seconds out. You can get lots of apps that will time that breathing. And so 6 seconds in, 6 seconds out, that's 12 seconds. Times that by 5, you've got a minute. So you're breathing at 5 breaths per minute. And research shows us that anything between 5 to 7 breaths per minute is your optimal pace of breathing. It delivers oxygen at a really regular pace. So what that does is, over time, that shifts your baseline of your nervous system. So if you're kind of quite a rattled sort of person, over time, that will shift the baseline so that you slowly change. The next thing that I would do is, I'm not a believer in sitting with your emotions. I think you should move them through you. Because if you think about cortisol, that's your get up and go. It's a good thing, you know. I think we demonize sympathetic and parasympathetic, like stress and no stress. So I don't call it that. I call it your go and no go response. So you need to get up and go, and you need to get things done. And sometimes, you know, the go-go response, it can be really expansive. So don't be frightened of challenge, because actually it's a good thing. You just want to move away from stuff that isn't good for you and actually makes you not feel very good or is debilitating for your system. And the no-go response is your relaxed, restorative, recalibration kind of responses. That, you don't also don't want to sit in that, because you'd be a sloth, you know, you'd have no ambition at all and you wouldn't get anything done. Actually, what you want to do with those two systems is you want to oscillate between the two. So something that we did was the rocking, and that's oscillation. So we were lying on the ground, we rocked through our heels, and that travels all the way up to your head. And that works on lots of different levels, because you're recalibrating your bones. So the two things that I'm really interested in is looking at the transmission of forces through your bones And if somewhere you're not moving very well from, you may be at your hip, you're not moving very well, it suggests to me that there's some contracted muscle there. And then we have to look at that. So I'd think about that. And moving from the bones is actually a really delicious way to move, because it's right in the core of you. You're not thinking about this external outer body, and muscles react quickly, but they're really slow to release. And soft tissue reacts really slowly. And your bones are kind of right there in the core of you. I think they really help to form your self-image. And also what it does is it discombobulates your nervous system. It doesn't know what you're doing. You're lying on the ground, so you're safe. You're breathing at this pace, it knows you're safe. And so it just goes, don't know what she's doing. Let's just contract and release muscle really quickly. So what you then do is that you are actually going in and out of your habit. So without thinking about it and without stretching, you have released muscle. So I work with movement from the brain end to affect the muscle. So I'm at the beginning of the process to affect the end of the process. And we're not stretching. It's a global release. Rolling. All of these things you would have done as a baby. Your nervous system, the structure of your nervous system isn't actually any different. You've just layered it on with, you know, a mortgage, a career, children, couple of unsuitable partners or five, you know, whatever it is that we load ourselves up with.
Really annoying cat. Yeah.
Whatever it is that you load yourself up with, really what you're looking for is exactly the same things that would have soothed you as a baby will still soothe you now.
Oh, that's very, very helpful. So thank you very much for coming along. Your book is Soothe, the book your nervous system has been longing for. And thank you for teaching us this weekend. Round of applause, I
think. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you.
Oh, I'm feeling so relaxed after re-listening to that lovely chat that we had with Naheed at the retreat. But we're at the end of the show. We know this isn't relaxing. We've got to come up with a nostalgia noodle, something in the depths of our pasts. What have you got this week, Lorraine?
Well, I am at the moment currently looking for Saturday jobs. I mean, he should be doing this himself, obviously. For my teenager, my 17-year-old, he's about to go into his mock A-levels, and then he will be hanging around for quite a lot of time because they finish early for revision and stuff. So I said, right, I'm going to get you a Saturday job. And it brought back memories of my own Saturday jobs, Trish. So I had a variety of Saturday jobs. One was seedlings for my biology teacher, planting seedlings in the greenhouse, which was quite nice. But, you know, this was in the days before a mobile phone or and he didn't have a radio in there. So I was in there for hours on my own potting seedlings.
Planting seeds.
With my own mind as company, Trish. You can imagine, can't you?
Oh, you could have been Monty Dawn. It could have gone in a different direction, your career.
Not really. And then my other job, and I used to go on my little moped up to a hotel for the disabled on the edge of the moors. Bear with me. It's gone very League of Gentlemen, hasn't it? Right on the edge of Bodmin Moor. I had to go through the fog, up the round the thing on my moped, cross a cattle grid.
Oh, no.
And then I would work I would be a waitress. I would get there quite bone shaky and be a waitress, and I'd have to show quite a lot of empathy. I was actually quite good as a waitress because I'm quite good at remembering, well, I was, I'm not now, obviously, I've forgotten everything in midlife, remembering all the specifics. And you can imagine in a hotel that caters towards the disabled, there's a lot of specifics as well. So I always quite enjoyed it because you did meet some interesting people.
Yeah.
But the lady had lots and lots of puppies and cats and things that all used to sleep in the Arga, which did worry me from a hygiene point of view.
I don't understand your past. It makes no sense to me. It's so bizarre. Now, I was going to sort of say to you, why are you finding your son a Saturday job? Actually, I just remembered my mum found me my first Saturday job. It was the greengrocers up around the corner. I got a little job there helping out in the greengrocers, but it was in the days where you had to weigh things and then you had to calculate how much it cost. So it would be like carrots would be 15p a pound. And if somebody wanted, you know, a quarter of a pound of carrots, and then you pop it in the little paper bag and you wrote it.
Oh, my goodness.
Terrible. I'm sure I'm lost a lot of money because I didn't know how to add up. It was absolutely hopeless. Didn't last very long at the greengrocers, but never mind. Never mind.
No, I used to do that when I worked in a pub as well. I'd just make it up because I couldn't add up.
Yeah.
Just hand them back some money.
Yeah, exactly. Hope for the best.
Oh, well, on that mathematical horror show, I think it's time to say goodbye. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode with two lovely interviews, two lovely guests. And we'll be back again same time next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.